Welcome to our Day 12 preview from the 2018 U.S. Open. I'm Ed Cohen with Ravi Uba and Jane McManus. Special welcome to tennis fans around the world listening in on Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. So looking to the men's semifinals, Ravi, Rafa Nadal, Juan Martín Del Potro, Kei Nishikori, and the sixth seed, Novak Djokovic. Let's begin with the first semifinal on Arthur Ashe Stadium court, Nadal and Del Potro. Can't forget about the quarterfinals at Wimbledon. Nadal down 2-1, fights back and takes it in five.
Yeah, these two are getting used to facing off in Grand Slams of late. Last year at the U.S. Open, Rafa winning that one in four. French Open winning in straights, and then Wimbledon winning in five. Now, closer inspection of those matches. You go to the French Open this year, it was won in straight sets by Rafa, but that didn't tell the entire story because the first set was very, very close. In fact, Del Potro had six break chances in two different games before Rafa had his first. And while Rafa saved all those break chances, he was able to break through at the end of the set and get that key break, and he never really looked back. So that was huge for him in that situation. And it's kind of been a running theme in their matches, especially of late, the fact that Rafa's done a fantastic job of saving break chances. Same thing happened at Wimbledon, as you say. He was down 2-1, won the fourth, got the break in the fifth set, and then after that had to save five break chances in two different games to make sure of the win. So he's playing all the big points better. I can't help but think that having that extra day, the one extra day to recover, is really going to help Rafa, because I think that if they had to play today, just the one day off between matches, I think Del Potro would have won this match. But I think it's going to be different. The conditions are slow, slower balls, a slower hard court. I think you could say with Del Potro sometimes with his footwork is a little bit slow. It might help him get the balls earlier. He can crank more. At the same time, hitting through Rafa on this court is going to be difficult. And kind of the big picture and what he has to go up against. Nadal 6-1 in their best of five set matches. The last time he lost was here, 2009 semifinals. So that's a lot for Del Potro to overcome.
Nadal surviving Dominic Thiem in arguably the match of this tournament. Come tomorrow, he's going to try and survive hard-hitting Juan Martín Del Potro.
In Wimbledon, he's a great player. He's a great player on grass. He's a great player everywhere. But the challenge of playing him on hard, of course, is even higher for me personally than playing against him on clay.
Notice the words Nadal used, on hard surfaces. Five wins all time for Del Potro against Nadal. All five on the hard court, including at Rio in the semifinals of the Olympics, including at the 2009 U.S. Open in the semifinals. Del Potro winning that tournament. He won that semifinal in straight sets. Del Potro on the matchup coming up in the semis against Nadal.
If I play Rafa, it could be another big battle as the Wimbledon match was. And of course, I like to play always with the number one of the world. That's a matter of the tournament or the conditions or the weather. I just have the chance to play the greatest on this sport, and it's amazing for me.
Big battles, Jane McManus. Both have had to endure some big matches so far here at the U.S. Open.
I was lucky enough to see that one in person at Wimbledon, and I can tell you that at that moment there was a match. England was playing Croatia in World Cup, but people were transfixed because the match between them was so entertaining. That just the contrast of styles that you see creates such entertaining tennis. I think fans are in for a treat.
Second semifinal. After Nadal and Del Potro, it's Kei Nishikori and Novak Djokovic. Keeping up with the theme of the Japanese here in Queens, New York. Osaka playing in the final on the women's side. Ravi, Nishikori, like Djokovic, he wasn't here a year ago, 21st seed, and here he is now back in the semifinals at the U.S. Open.
Ed, allow me just to mention one more stat when it comes to Rafa. He's won 16 of his last 17 Slam semifinals, so just the one loss to Djokovic. Nishikori, if there's a time to be facing Djokovic, despite that 2-14 record against him, it could be now, because there have been three matches that Djokovic has had this U.S. Open where he's really struggled physically. We saw it yesterday with John Millman when it looked like he was on the verge of potentially losing that second set, and it could have been all different if Millman didn't take that little break at 2-all in the second set. But the thing is, the conditions are going to be better in terms of not as hot tomorrow, so that presumably would help Djokovic. But again, is there going to be a cumulative effect? Now, Nishikori has managed to test Djokovic of late. This year, Wimbledon four sets, and he had his chances in the third. He had break points when they were on serve to take really full advantage of that match, or a stranglehold of that match. Wasn't able to do it. Played earlier, went to three sets, the maximum three sets on clay. But the last time they did face off, or here at the US Open, 2014, in the semis, at that time Nishikori won, but that was a very, very hot, hot day. So there the conditions really affected Djokovic. Boris Becker said as much, that the sun hit his man first, so that was a big factor. We hope for a really good contest. You know, Nishikori is somebody who does a great job of taking away an opponent's time. Takes the ball early. And so Djokovic knows he potentially has to do a lot of running in the match. So I think he's going to come out really, really focused tomorrow, Djokovic. And you talked about Delpo, you know, winning the first set. Maybe that's going to be important for him. Same thing. I think if Nishikori can get that first set, then it's going to be very interesting.
On Nishikori, he won the second set against Djokovic at Wimbledon. It was 1-1, Djokovic winning the final two sets, 6-2 and 6-2. In the series, remember, Djokovic lost two of his first three meetings to Nishikori, including that semifinal here at the Open in 2014. But Novak, 13 straight victories against Kei Nishikori.
I mean, I can't really say he's a great matchup for me. I mean, I have a very good, head-to-head score against him. But you're right. I mean, because he plays so fast, he makes me more alert from the first point, because I know I have to be at my best, in order to compete with him from the baseline.
Nishikori in this U.S. Open, he's taken down Diego Schwartzman. He took down Philipp Kohlschreiber, and in the rematch of the 2014 U.S. Open final, the quarters this time, it was Nishikori in a five-setter against Marin Cilic. Cilic forced a fifth set. Nishikori takes that quarterfinal 6-4. And now setting up a showdown, trying to get the best of Djokovic in the semis here at the 2018 U.S. Open.
I don't have great record against Novak, but always, it's been a tough match last couple of years, and I seen a chance, but I haven't able to make the last step. But yeah, always excited to play Novak.
Ravi Uba, what's going to be the difference for Kei Nishikori tomorrow to make that correct step?
I think he has to have a very, very good serving day. He can't afford any of the lulls he had against Marin Cilic. And I somehow think that maybe he's going to this one kind of with a free hit, because he should have lost that match to Cilic. He was down a set, down 4-2. Cilic let him off the hook in the second set, also in the third set tiebreak. Cilic was up a mini break, serving in 4-3, hit back-to-back double faults. So he probably should have been out of the tournament. And going into the match against Djokovic, I think he'll have less pressure, far less pressure on his shoulders. And the one thing he wouldn't mind doing maybe is going to a fifth set, because when it comes to deciding sets and matches, be it the third or fifth set, he has one of the best records ever in tennis. He's won 76% of those matches. So if it goes deep, and of course he beat Andy Murray here, right, five sets a couple of years ago, he's a great, great competitor. The only thing that for me that has held him back were a couple of things. He's not the biggest of players, right? He's not the tallest of players, so he can't really bang the serve down. But number two, or maybe because of that, he's had a lot of little injuries. And this one, he had a right wrist injury at the start of the year. Thankfully, after that, he's been able to be, in a clean bill of health. So I hope he can really test Djokovic. And if he can, it's going to be a real blockbuster.
Djokovic, 14-2 all-time against Nishikori. Nadal, 11-5 all-time against Del Potro. Stop us if you've heard this. Familiar names in the semifinals at the U.S. Open again. Nadal, Del Potro will kick it off. Nishikori and Djokovic to follow for a spot in Sunday's final in men's singles. And that is our Day 12 preview. For Ravi Uba and Jane McManus, I'm Ed Cohen. Thanks for listening. Join us for complete live coverage on U.S. Open Radio, presented by American Express. You can find us on usopen.org or the U.S. Open app.
This year on Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open, we're going behind the scenes and meeting the personalities that make the U.S. Open what it is. And Nick McCarville here. I've been podcasting all year long. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor, because we've been celebrating 50 years of open-air tennis, 50 years of the U.S. Open. And the man that's really brought that to life in many ways is our very own Steve Flink. He's a Hall of Famer, he's a journalist, he's a historian, he's a writer, and he's an all-around good guy that wears some pretty good ties. He's got another one of those ties on today. But
how do I live up to that billing, Nick? Very nice.
I so appreciate you taking the time, first off, Steve. But this year you've gotten to talk to so many different legends. I guess first off, just generally, how great has it been for you to walk down memory lane? You've got to talk about that first U.S. Open in 1968, but then so much more with some of the biggest stars in the game.
Yeah, it's been an incredible collection of players and personalities, as you know. And we started in the early stages with Virginia Wade, the first U.S. Open women's champion, had Tony Trabert, who didn't play much in the Open. He played the doubles in the first Open, but had such an impact before that. And he was the last American to win, by the way, before Arthur Ashe, the last one to win the U.S. Championships, did it in 55, and then it wasn't until Arthur won that first Open in 68, another American triumph. But those were some of the early ones. Then Stan Smith and Rod Laver, and then from there, eventually we got to the likes of Lendl and Chang and Everett and Austin, and moved on to Pete Sampras and John McEnroe. And it was a joy to do all those interviews, because I lived through their experiences and saw them at the time and wanted to hear them relive them now. So I had great enjoyment out of doing those podcasts.
Steve, I know that obviously you have an encyclopedic memory, and you've got almost, I feel like you can pull out numbers and stats and moments like no one else, but what was the experience like in preparing for those interviews? Because if you've listened to them, and you can go back to any of our previous episodes on Courtside and listen to them, we've also been featuring a lot of those interviews this U.S. Open, but you've gotten to pull out some great details, and that takes prompting, that takes a lot of work from you to be ready for those people in those moments.
Yes and no. I wanted to organize it well, Nick, but so much of that is on the top of my head, and I remember it sometimes more clearly than the player, and sometimes it's identical, but I'm fortunate that I can draw on my recall when I do those. So yes, I did type the questions out and organize them, but it really didn't involve a lot of research, because those memories and matches are just so vivid.
Yeah, and for you, what's been in a personal sense? How has the experience been taking a walk down so many different memory lanes?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I'd never done this type of work. I've interviewed players for magazine stories, but to do this for the podcast and have sort of an open, the time frame not really compressed in most cases. And some of them went 30 minutes, as you know. Andy Roddick closer to an hour. He was one of the best, by the way, I thought. Very entertaining. And some of them, like McEnroe and Sampras, were more in the range of 50 minutes. It was nice to not be too worried about any kind of clock getting in our way. It was more a matter with the players. Did they have the time? And they did. And I'd never had an experience quite like it. And I ended up enjoying it more and more as it unfolded.
I have to say, too, when, you know, the names, when we're exchanging emails and planning out podcasts, the names that you and Brian Beglin, who has helped produce this podcast all year long, continuing to put out, you know, the Roddick and the McEnroe and the Chris Everett, that's all due, I think, to your Rolodex, too.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and I was happy about that. I was happy that I could use my relationships with these players that go back so long and have them accommodate me and make the time and then be able to provide it for our podcast, because I think in the end, the real winners are the listeners to hear these players reminiscing. So I tried, as I'm sure you noticed, I tried to lay back. If I had things to say, I said them. It was nice to have exchanges, but I thought it was more important to let them get their memories and experiences across and let them carry the day that way. But I enjoyed it immensely.
I thought it was so interesting. One of, you know, not necessarily a name that resonates that well now is Nancy Ritchie, 1968 French
right.
Open.
Right.
I thought that was such an interesting interview because of all the chaos that was surrounding that tournament that year.
So true, because she won the first French Open and there were all these strikes going on and how were they going to get to the courts. And it was sheer chaos. And then she also told the story about how she didn't play the first U.S. Open because it was a transitional period and the USTA didn't want to give her the expense money, $900, which is amusing now in retrospect. But she was terrific. and she has her nice Texas drawl, and I know her a bit, and I've written about her in the past, and she was one of the players I watched as a kid growing up. I saw her famous comeback against Billie Jean in Madison Square Garden when she was down a 6-4, 5-1, and won 12 games in a row for the match, and so I saw a lot of her, and I saw her get to the finals here at the Open in 69. So that was a fun one, and I'm glad that had an impact on you. I hope it did on a lot of the listeners, because she doesn't get the recognition she deserves. She won a French and she won an Australian and is in the Hall of Fame, but not quite as well known as many of the other players that were part of this series.
I also found it interesting too, Steve, in the interviews that you did do, like players like Monica Seles and Pete Sampras, both which were awesome interviews, but they're just players that for whatever reason they've chosen not to stay that close to the sport. Now they're still a part of it, obviously, but they're not commentators, they're not at all the big tournaments, and it was kind of refreshing to hear them be a part of tennis in a way that, you know, they've taken a step back from tennis in a way.
Yeah, I hold them both in the highest regard. I don't know her as well as I know Pete, but you're right. You were right to sort of lump them together in that sense, and you're right. They have earned the right to go in their own direction and not necessarily be in the forefront of the sport or at the center of the way so many former champions are. Obviously, McEnroe is still so attached to this game as a commentator. But it was fun to hear them as a result. And again, the fans don't hear from them as much either. So I think those two, which were close together in our sequence, were both excellent.
You mentioned the Andy Roddick interview, the American former world number one 2003 champion here 15 years ago, if you can believe it. But you said that was one of your most favorite. I mean, Andy's another one who's kind of danced around doing some commentary work. I think he's very much into his family right now and the kids that he and Brooklyn have together. But why was that one of the ones that bubbled to the top for you?
Well, the first reason is I got to know him better when I was inducted alongside Andy in the 2017 class of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. That gave me a chance to, there were a number of times over the course of that weekend where we had a chance to talk, and then at the dinner during the Open, at the end of the U.S. Open last year, again, spent a lot of time talking to him at the cocktail party. And so I think we developed a nice rapport, and I thought what made that one special was he was so expansive on everything. His recollections were so sharp, as were Chang's, by the way. Michael Chang remembered every match he's ever played. He was his memory was not lacking in the least. And Andy was just so candid. What I admire about him is he's self-critical. He's not a defeatist. He's not negative. But if he thinks he did something wrong at a certain time, he tells you. If he's made mistakes in the past as a player, that came through, that he didn't see himself as perfect, that he sees himself as a human being. And I thought that was one of the more remarkable ones we had in the series was definitely Roddick.
Well, and you mentioned Michael Chang too. I liked the way that he spoke with you about the challenges that he faced, not only as a smaller guy, but as an Asian American, a young kid who wasn't necessarily tapped as the next big thing. And in a way, he really helped pave the way for guys like Agassi, Sampras, Courier, Todd Martin, who would kind of carry us into that great generation of American tennis.
So true, because he led the way with the 89 French Open win. We spent a lot of time talking about that in addition to his run to the finals at the U.S. Open of 96. I think those were the two chief topics. But yeah, Michael was very self-effacing, and he wouldn't look at it as leading the way, but he did, because he kind of opened the eyes of Sampras, who came along the next year and won the U.S. Open and the youngest ever to win that. Well, Michael had been the youngest ever to win the French, and it sort of took off from there, with Courier winning his back-to-back French and Australian Opens, and then, of course, Agassi getting in the mix in 92 at Wimbledon. All happened so fast, but Michael was the lead-off hitter.
Yeah, he really was. A lot of great anecdotes, I think, out of all of them that you've drawn out. I'm in my early 30s. I didn't know this. The Tracy Austin going to McDonald's after she won the U.S.
Yes,
Open? Is
yes,
that right?
Absolutely. Her first one, youngest ever at 16 in 1979, beating Martina Navratilova and Chrissy Evert back-to-back. But it was after the win over Chrissy. Yeah, they stopped off at a McDonald's, and she told that story in a very nice way. I thought she was terrific because she was so... she would say things like, well, you saw our matches, what did you think? I was really impressed with her in that interview. But the McDonald's story was a fun story, and she definitely looks back on it fondly. And obviously a few people maybe recognized her, but here's the U.S. Open champion going to McDonald's to celebrate.
It's amazing. In the drive-thru with their family, no less, on Long Island.
Right.
Lastly, Steve, just for you, you know, what's been your favorite part, or what's this experience been like for you, and how have you sort of had the chance to reflect on your own career through it?
I felt like I learned something by doing those podcasts, because it's not the same as taping an interview from your home or one-on-one in person for print, where you want to just make sure there's some good exchanges, some good back and forth with the players, which I had, and I felt like as we went from the early ones with the likes of Treybird and Stan Smith and Labor, that I'd like to believe I did a better job as we went along, and because I got a better feel for what was needed. But I also think all the players from the beginning made it very easy for me.
Yeah, well, you guys were a perfect match, you and all of your interview subjects. The next segment of the podcast, as always, is here's our very own Steve Flink talking with one of the legends of the game. And once again, Steve, thank you very much.
Nick, thanks. I enjoyed it.
Celebrating 50 years of the U.S. Open with Mats Wielander. Our guest today is celebrating a 30th anniversary of his U.S. Open triumph in less than a month. Mats Wielander grew up in Sweden and established himself as a great champion during his peak years across the 1980s. He won all of the majors with the exception of Wimbledon. He was the world's number one ranked player in 1988 when he took three of the four majors, becoming the first man to realize that feat since Jimmy Connors in 1974. Mats was a masterful strategist, a durable competitor, and a commendable individual. Now, you come back in 83 to the U.S. Open for your second time around, and there's Lendl again, this time in the quarters. Again, he beat you pretty decisively. How did that loss differ from the year before? Did you feel you were making inroads as a hard court player by then?
Well, I mean, it's the same. I didn't feel any different. I mean, I was a better player in 83. I had a great year in 83, but the strange thing was that I lost to Lendl in 82 in the fourth round, and then a couple of weeks later, I beat him at the Spanish Open, or the Barcelona Open, I should say, on clay again. And then we played on hard courts in the US Open. So I couldn't bridge the gap. I didn't really understand what I needed to do. I didn't have a slice backhand to keep the ball low. So, yeah, the gap. I was closing in on the best players in the world during 83. But, again, same thing on hard courts. But I have to say, I won Cincinnati on hard courts the week before US Open, a couple of weeks before, and I had some good wins there. I beat McEnroe. I even think I might have beaten Lendl, but two out of three sets in a smaller tournament was a big difference. What I found in 83 was 82 was kind of, I'm new here. This is great. New York City. How fun is this? In 83, I started to, wow, it smells differently at the U.S. Open. Flushing Meadow was loud, was messy, not in a negative way, but it was just noisy, messy. People would walk into their seats during points, and I started to, do I really like this place or do I not like this place at the moment? So yeah. I was battling more than just Lendl there. I was obviously happy to get to the quarters, but there was a lot of sort of transition thoughts of being just a top 10 player to become one of the best players in the world and then feeling helpless against Lendl once again.
So, Mats, I thought that was a period of getting acquainted. Now by 84, you come up against another really tough fast court player, hard court player in Pat Cash in the quarters again. And he won it in four sets. But how did you feel about that one? Was he too good because he was just coming forward incessantly and pressing you and getting to the net with alacrity and just making you come up with too many passing shots?
Yes, he was. Pat Cash was a strange, and sort of Pat Cash and Stefan Edberg and Boris Becker, I kind of put them in the same category for me, because I didn't get a chance to play against Becker, Cash, and Edberg in big matches on clay, because I hope they're not listening. They wouldn't usually make their seed. So I never get to play them in the fourth round or the quarters, the same as at the French Open. So I never built up the confidence against those three guys. And Pat Cash was one I've never played on clay. And I lost him in Wimbledon. I lost him at US Open. So I, again, he was a different serving volleyer from John McEnroe. He was more forceful, most probably a better volleyer than McEnroe.
That's a great compliment. Why? Because he was more decisive?
He had just a better first volley. He was bigger at the net. He covered the net better. He obviously didn't have as good a hand as John McEnroe. McEnroe was better from the baseline. He was a better all-court player, I thought. But in terms of coming to the net, Pat Cash was just all over the net. And again, because of the lack of power in some of my passing shots, I had to hit sort of two or three shots before I could get it by him. And the U.S. Open, as I remember, was quite fast. The Louis Armstrong was quite fast in those days. And it was very reminiscent of Wimbledon in many ways when you played against a certain volume. So, yeah, good match for me. Again, I was not ever looking to do extremely well on hard courts. But, again, I won Cincinnati in 83. I won it in 84, and I came to the U.S. Open. And, again, I had higher expectations. But, obviously, Cash should have beaten Lendl in the semis. He had match points. So it wasn't that disappointing. I just had to, again, serve better and develop that other part of my game, which was called aggressiveness. I don't like that word.
Well, I can understand that, Max. But look, by 85, it seemed to me, just watching you year by year there, you really were improving as a hardcore player every single year. So in 85, you got to the semis. You played McEnroe on one of the most scorching, oppressive afternoons I can ever remember at the Open. And you led 2-1 before he finally prevailed in 5. What are your recollections of that one? And that was obviously a fine performance from you against John. What do you remember about it?
What I remember the most about it is that I spoke to John on the phone after the finals, as I was heading back to Sweden, and he said something like, "I can't believe we did that. We played that long on Saturday," because I was dead for the finals against Lendl the day after. So I'm like, well, you should have let me win, John, because I wasn't dead. But no, I tell you what, the U.S. Open in 85 was a complete different situation. I had just run into my wife on the middle Sunday at Flushing Meadow. I'd just beaten Christo van Rensburg, and I was walking through the crowd, no security, of course, in those days, and I was walking from Louis Armstrong over to the locker room, which was then in the next to the indoor courts. And I remember walking through, and this little guy from South Africa pulled me over and said, "Hey, Mats Wielander." And I'm like, "Yes." He said, "I want to have a word with you." I'm gonna start talking to him. I'm still in my, you know, bag and sweaty, whatever. And he said, we kept talking and talking. I said, "Listen, I got to go. I have a press conference. And do you want me to sign an autograph or something?" And he said, "No, hold on a second. She wants to talk to you too." So my wife was standing next to him. She wasn't interested at all. And I'm like, "Wow, really? Are you sure?" So I ran into a new sort of world, because this was a photographer's agent. My wife was working as a fashion model. And I started going to restaurants and a nightclub, and I was hanging out with these South Africans that live in New York City. So I started liking New York City. And by the time I played John, it's like, "Oh, wow, I love this place." Suddenly, instead of just my coach in my player's box, I had another 7 people. I had another sort of 10, 15 people up in the stands. So I had people rooting for me, and that made the biggest difference, not just for my life, because obviously I'm still married to her, to Sonia, 31 years later. But that made me, I don't know, somehow enjoy New York City and enjoy the match against John. I thought I had a really good chance to win. It was the first time I started serving and volleying on hard courts quite consistently. I tried to take the net away from John. But again, he was not intimidating necessarily, but I was always struck by his fighting spirit. Because when you watch him as a kid, you always look at his temperament and whatever. But in that match, I realized, obviously, the Davis Cup in 82, but in 85 more so, I think, my goodness, he's a lion. He's not going anywhere. And I was playing well. So that match, again, was one of those where I'm really close to beating these guys. But I was helped by a lot of outside elements in playing that match.
So, Matt, so next year you lost to Miloslav Machir, who, of course, was always a tricky opponent for everyone and it's kind of a very highly unusual player, you know, lots of touch and feel, and he was unconventional, yeah. You might say. But then now we go to 87, though, and that's when you got to your first final. And you beat Machir, and you also beat Edberg. And you're playing Lendl. My big recollection is it's a set-all. It was a day late, the final, because it was rained out on the Sunday. But so you play on the Monday, and it's one set-all, and Lendl's down 5-6, 15-40. And you had the feeling whoever won that set was probably going to win the match. And he somehow got out of it with an ace and a drop volley. Do you remember him escaping in the third? And did that carry over in your mind into the fourth? What do you remember about that final?
I remember that I lost to him in a really close French Open final, 7-6 in the fourth. It was getting really dark, and I was stuck in a situation where I could not beat Lendl on any surface anymore. And I was really close in 87, that's for sure. I was most probably a little bit thrown off by the fact that we played on Monday, because I had scheduled a bowling session at Union Square in New York City on Sunday night, and all my friends were, because I was living in Manhattan at the time, and they were, well, you can't pull out now, Matt, so we're going bowling. So I was like, oh, okay, I got to go bowling on Sunday night. I'm playing U.S. Open Finals on Monday. So I was, I thought I had a good chance. But again, it was, if I win the third, I'd most probably be really close to winning. But he just had my number for a few years there on all the different surfaces. And
so did it sting? Did it sting or not, Matt? So that you
Didn't. No, not so. That wasn't that bad. The U.S. Open, French Open Final 87, U.S. Open 87 wasn't that bad. The one that really stung was the finals of the Masters at the Madison Square Garden, because we played that too.
Yeah.
And that one really hurt, because he beat me in three straight sets, and I was completely overpowered. So that, yes, it stung, but the finals in 87, again, I felt at home in New York City. I felt at home at Flushing Meadow. I was improving. I just got married, and we were looking at houses in Greenwich, Connecticut. So I'm like, okay, I might be losing the U.S. Open final, but I'm still number two in Greenwich, Connecticut, because, of course, Ivan lived there too. I'm like, I can't have this anymore. So, but no, I think all the matches, all the finals against him in the slams that I lost, I think I felt that I was getting closer and closer to him. Obviously, it's unnerving to not know if you're ever going to beat him.
So it's the perfect segue, Mats, to 1988, because that was obviously your greatest campaign ever. You won the Australian in a great final from Pat Cash in five sets, and you won the French, and you did lose to Machir at Wimbledon in the quarters, but came into the Open with many people believing this was finally going to be your time. And you had a tough five-setter with Kevin Curran early and a tough one later on with Emilio Sanchez. But then into the finals, and there's Lendl again. You tell us. I have my memories, and I know the details of that match. Tell me what you remember most about finally winning the U.S. Open in 88 and this titanic five-setter with Ivan Lendl.
What I remember most is I've never played a match tactically the way I played that match beforehand, and I've never played a match tactically with success that way afterwards, because I decided early on in the match that I need to stay away from his forehand, but obviously I have to find a way to hit some kind of shot into the forehand that he can't hurt me with. So early on I figured out that I got to hit a lot of slice backhands. Obviously, you got to hit most of the shots to his backhand, but when I go to the forehand, it's either got to be really wide with a cross-court forehand of my own, or if I get a backhand, I cannot hit my normal two-hander down the line and open up the court. I got to take my medicine, hit something low, slicey, that he has to hit up on, and then attack. So I found a way to hit into his forehand, and then he gave me some kind of high, spinny, short shot that I can then attack with my two-handed backhand. and then hopefully come to the net. So
and you came. And speaking of that, Matt, you came in 131 times across the five sets, which was extraordinary. And you think that was the defining factor of the match? Was that what really did it?
Well, it is to Ivan, because a couple of years ago I heard Ivan answer one of my questions. I did an interview for Eurosport, and he said, "Well, I if Matt stays at the back, if you stay at the back, you have no chance. You're never going to beat me." So he realized, I think that I don't want to lose. Basically, it was one of those. I don't want to lose to Ivan one more time with a match that looks the way it has looked in the past. So I was willing to do anything to just change the look of the match. And then it turned out that it was actually good tactics. I mean, again, I was most probably unlucky in 87 to not win that third set, but lucky to win in 88. But I think you have to add to that Lender was number one in the world. He'd been there for a few years. I think this was his sixth or seventh finals in a row. So I think he was. I got him on a day and a year that maybe his tennis was slightly coming down a little bit, and mine was always coming up. But yeah, I hit more than 1,200 slice backhands. Somebody has counted and came in over 100 times. So again, I've tried to play like that after that match, but I never had any success doing it. So something was very specific.
So Matt, about that match. You clearly earned that triumph, and it was 4 hours and 55 minutes.
Yeah.
Put it in perspective. How was that in many ways the most gratifying win of your career, to finally win the Open where you'd had some tough luck, especially the year before, to come through and win your third major of the season?
It was gratifying, obviously, for many reasons. I was the first Swede to win the U.S. Open, which really, that doesn't really matter. But I've seen Bjorn Borg lose so many finals there, of staying up all night. And then, he lost again. So that was obviously on my mind. Being number one in the world, if I won, was on my mind. The most important part of that, I think, was that my dad, who passed away in May 1990, came to the United States once in his life, and he came for the week before the U.S. Open in 88, obviously stayed through the 2 weeks, and to have afterwards, obviously I didn't know that at the time, but to have him there for the first time, and then I won the U.S. Open, and now afterwards realizing that was the only time he came. So something was aligned in many ways. This was kind of my time, and I was working really hard. I think I worked the hardest of all players those couple of years, 87, 88, off the court. I took a page out of Lendl's sort of physical training regime off the court, and I got rewarded for it. So, yeah, I think it's my biggest win. It's definitely my best match in terms of execution and also in terms of tactics.
Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. Thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.